I'm Chris Williamson, Deputy Leader of the Workers' Party, former member of Labour Member of Parliament for 7.5 years and Shadow Minister, and before that, Council Leader and member of the Labour Party for 44 years.
What do you make of the newish Starmer Labour Party, but most recently the budget? What do you make of it?
Well, not a lot, really. Look, there's no real difference now between Labour and the Conservatives, or indeed any of the mainstream political parties in the House of Commons at the moment, if you can consider Reform as a mainstream political party, I suppose, given the number of votes that they had, they do merit that, that description. But no, they're all committed to neoliberal economic prospectus and are really not serving the interests of the British public. They're actually looking after the interests of global corporations.
Can you give us a quick idea of what you mean by this word neoliberal?
Well, essentially, it's a small state and, you know, market is king. You know, the market will provide the solution to all the nation's woes. And we know that for the last 40 odd years that it is being implemented on the British, or inflicted, should I say, on the British people, it absolutely has failed to solve the problems. It's made the situation considerably worse. I mean, we've got now one in five people living in poverty in the country, which is the sixth biggest economy in the world. We're one of the wealthiest nations on earth, and we have, you know, one in five, 14, 15 million people in poverty in Britain. It's an absolute scandal. But that's really as a direct consequence, I think, of the policies which have been pursued really since 1979, although the road was made clear for them by Dennis Healey going to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise in 1976. And so over that period of time, we've seen privatisations of our utilities and other industries which were in the public sector when Thatcher came to office in 1979. But it's gone considerably further than that now. And we're seeing lots of our public services, like the National Health Service, for example, lots of the services which are being provided by the NHS might have the NHS badge on the front of them, but they're actually being provided by the private sector. And what they are doing is using our public services as a cash cow to make profits for these global corporations. And it's a scandal. And, you know, we need to reverse that. The only party, it seems to me, that is offering that at the moment, that's got any chance, really, I think, of making a breakthrough, is the Workers' Party. We got over 200,000 votes at the last general election. We had 151 candidates. We didn't expect the election to come when it did, so we were taken slightly unawares, if I'm honest. Like most people, we were expecting an election in the autumn. And had that been the case, we would have had over 500 candidates. And I think we would have had a fighting chance of getting some of those candidates over the line. We would have certainly achieved a lot more than 200,000 votes, although that does make us the sixth biggest political party by votes in the country. And, you know, I think people are crying out for an alternative. And, you know, what we've got to really try and focus on now, it seems to me, is to, you know, marshal our message and try and get it out there to the wider general public. But what we found in the election, of course, was that we were ghosted, really. The mainstream media didn't give us any attention whatsoever. And I think had we had that oxygen of publicity, then again, I think that would have, even though we were only fielding 151 candidates, I think we would have had a better chance of getting some of our people over the line.
So, Chris, do you think you spread yourself a bit thin? There's a lot of candidates.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's one view which some people have articulated, although by having over 100 candidates, it did give us the ability to have party political broadcasts and, you know, that kind of visit where helps to get the message out there. We're a small party, and, you know, that perhaps is something maybe we could have, you know, focused our attention on more, on a fewer number of seats. But I think what we wanted to try and do was to, you know, give people an option really as in as many places as we possibly could to vote for the Workers' Party. And by having the number of candidates that we did, that enabled us to garner, as I've said, over 200,000, I think it was 210,000 votes across the country. Now, had we got one of our people over the line, and this was one of the reasons why we were seeking a bigger number of candidates, is that under the state funding rules for political parties, it's called short money, you gain access to that if you can get one MP elected and at least 150,000 votes across the country. So that was kind of driving our thinking, really, that even in some of those constituencies where we didn't, you know, pick up a huge number of votes, it did all help to add to that overall total.
Yeah, well, this is a grist to the mill, water under the bridge, whatever you want to call it. Look, if you go back to 2010 and the LibCom coalition, enormous austerity was brought in then following the 2008 bailouts. And one of the biggest effects of this, I mean, certainly here in Bristol, was the closing of a lot of care homes, state care homes, elderly care homes particularly, and the cutting back, massive cutting back of education, particularly funding of special educational needs and that sort of thing. But so there's a constant battle at the moment within local government. I think possibly similar things going on in central government. Over trying to care, and of course this budget, I mean, Labour were complaining like mad about the lack of the Tories dealing with social care, and of course there was an opportunity to do that in this budget. Nothing whatsoever, not even a whisper.
No, well, as I say, I mean, look, you know, Rachel Reeves is serving the interests of corporate capitalism, and we've heard from the health secretary shortly after the general election, when he was installed in that position, Wes Streeting, that he said that the NHS is no longer simply a public service. He said it's an economic development department. He talks about, you know, the begging bowl culture in the National Health Service, where there's been calls for greater investment in the NHS. And he refers to that in the sort of pejorative way of suggesting that it's a begging bowl culture. This is an absolutely kind of outrageous sort of proposition from a political party, you know, that has a fine tradition. I mean, let's remember, it was the Labour Party that established the National Health Service back in 1948. But they are actually destroying it now, and they're continuing the privatisation agenda. And of course, yes, I mean, you know, social care should be free at the point of need, but we should be bringing all of our utilities, all of these public service public services that have gone out to the private sector, should be brought back into public ownership. And the privateers, which are, you know, running our public services like the National Health Service and social care service, so they should all be kicked out, and we should bring it all under the public sector. We would be able to provide, I think, better quality service, treat our workers, the workers in those areas better, with proper terms and conditions, decent pensions and so on. And you know, you remove the profit motive from these public services.
Well, right, you know, now the farmers are complaining, protesting on Tuesday about inheritance tax, family farms being taken off of farmers, which is a enormous change, even over centuries. You know, this is a massive change going on that Rachel Reeves has started now in the countryside. Yeah. With it, you know, what the farmers are saying essentially is, look, we can barely make a profit, let alone build up a farm to pass on to our kids. And now you're saying that when we do, we're going to have to pay this massive slice of tax as well. So it means that they're for a start, they're afraid to die. I mean, suddenly they're thinking, God, if I die, my kids are going to have a massive bill to pay and have to lose the farm. And even if they do sell the land, they've got capital gains tax on that as well. Yeah, so it's almost as if they don't like, well, it's quite clear they don't like farmers. And the excuse for this that Rachel Reeves is giving is that we've just got to get in tax from somewhere. Now, explain what you think, you know, whether you think it really is necessary? I mean, obviously, there are people like Amazon, they're not taxing and et cetera. But, you know, if you were sitting there in her shoes, looking at this whole situation of less and less coming in tax, more and more power of multinationals to avoid and evade tax, and wealthy individuals keeping most of their wealth offshore away from the tax man, what would you do about it?
Well, there's a number of things really there. Firstly, I think you're right in relation to the farmers, and it's another scandal, and it's another indication really of the Labour government serving the interests of global corporations. I mean, what we're going to see now is large tracts of land, farmland in Britain being bought up by the likes of BlackRock, as we've seen in Ukraine, buying up large swathes of Ukraine. And it's a kind of privatisation of the globalisation, shall we say, maybe, of the of the British farm.
Yeah, it's like a new, almost like a modern version of the enclosures from the 18th yes. century.
Yes, indeed. And well, you know, that beautiful countryside, you know, is actually provided really by the farming community. You know, when you get the likes of BlackRock getting their teeth into it, I can't think that they will have the, you know, the beauty of the countryside as a top priority, let alone the welfare of the animals. But look, I mean, the whole issue about tax, I mean, it's a misnomer anyway, because taxes don't fund our public services in any event. I mean, this is a con, this is a myth. We have a fiat currency in this country. It's not backed by any commodity, as used to be the case. We used to be part of what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, but Richard Nixon jettisoned that in 1971. So it's been a floating fiat currency ever since. And this is why, going back to 1976, when Dennis Healey went to the International Monetary Fund on a false premise that somehow Britain was running out of money, was absolutely absurd. You can't run out of money when you're issuing the currency. It's not the availability of money that's the issue. And this whole, you know, talk about a financial black hole is complete garbage. There is no black hole. And the government's got access to all the money it needs. It just a few keystrokes in the treasury, and you know, the money is provided. What they need to focus on is actually identifying and creating, where it doesn't exist, the real resources in the economy. And what I mean by that is the labor, the skilled labor in certain circumstances to do the things that need to be done in the country, and the availability of the materials to improve the infrastructure, build the houses, and so on and so forth. But the actual availability of money is not an issue at all. And we've been conned by this for years and years and years. And I think some of the people actually genuinely believe it. But that isn't really how the economy works. And a quote I often remind people of is what Henry Ford said many years ago, when he said, if people understood how the banking and the monetary system actually operated, there'd be a revolution by tomorrow morning. I mean, my ambition has been to try and, you know, create that revolution for the last few years. I think more and more people are waking up, but unfortunately, those sitting in the Houses of Parliament, there is not a solitary soul who's making the case that, you know, the argument that Rachel Reeves is putting forward about a financial black hole and about, you know, the need to levy taxes. Nobody's making that point that this is all a myth. Taxes are required, obviously, to generate a value for the currency, because it's a worthless piece of paper otherwise. You need to pay your taxes in pound sterling. So that creates and generates a value for the currency. But it's also important, taxes are also important to address inflation. So, for example, if you had a situation where government was wanting to invest in, say, infrastructure, housing, whatever it might be, and they started, because the economy was then overheating, where the government was then competing for resources and labor, et cetera, with the private sector, then that would create an inflationary pressure. We're nowhere near that situation at the moment. But were that situation to arise, well, the taxation system can be then used to dampen the demand from the private sector to create the space for the government, for those public priorities. And of course, taxes are necessary to drive certain consumer spending habits. So, for example, you know, environmentally, you know, if government priorities to on a particular area which is, you know, better for the environment, and they can encourage people to spend money in on particular products which are less energy requiring, as you know, large amounts of energy to get people to buy things which are more efficient, as it were. It can be used for things like that, or indeed to deter people from smoking and things like that. So, you know, tackling inequality, to tax, because obviously these wealthy billionaires that you mentioned at the top of our discussion have a lot of power. And the more money they have, you know, goes with that lots and lots of power. So, you know, taxes is necessary to address the inequality in the country. And then
interrupt you just very quickly. I mean, the Kevin Carhill is a good friend of this program. He used to work on the Sunday Times Rich List back in the late 1980s. He got a front page lead in the Sunday Times whilst the editor was on holiday. It was a deputy editor saying the rich pays no tax. Now, this is a great sort of thing I can imagine now in a newspaper. You're unlikely to see it. But I find it amazing that even the Labour Party have not been able to deal with this situation where you've got the super rich have actually used their political muscle and financial muscle to make sure that they really do not pay tax. They're hardly touched by the system, exactly. Whereas the middle classes and the working classes and actually even kids, you know, are getting hit by VAT, et cetera, are the ones that do.
It's crazy. And I mean, I was just about to come on to actually in relation to that. Obviously, more effort needs to be done to stop the evasion. Look, Jeremy Corbyn was talking about doing this and closing down the loopholes. There's lots of British territories around the world which are used as tax havens. It was talking about, closing that opportunity off so that, the rich who deposit their resources there and to avoid tax would no longer have that ability to do that. So there are options available, to the government to clamp down on these wealthy billionaires to make sure they do pay their fair share, because, we've seen over the last sort of 40 years that the growth in billionaires and millionaires has grown exponentially at the same time as we've seen poverty growing exponentially. I mean, back in the mid-1970s, just before Healy actually went to the International Monetary Fund, I mean, inequality was at its narrowest in this country. And so every single year from 1945, with the election of that first majority Labour government, they set in train, as you know, a post-war consensus that saw a narrowing of inequality. And that narrowing continued every single year right the way through to the mid-1970s. And, that was a time when, trade union power was at its height and where working class people really did have many more options than they have today. And we all working class youngsters knew they were going to have a better standard of living than their parents did. They were guaranteed a job. They could, access housing, buy homes, get access to council housing. All this is gone now. But it could be got back. I mean, it's not impossible to get back. I mean, these things can, I mean, we've done it before and, we could do it again. But, that 1979 election was a seminal moment. Of course, we saw the North Sea oil revenues being just squandered and we saw that when Thatcher came in, those oil fields being privatised. And so Britain never got the benefits of that. And obviously we saw also with this kind of whole neoliberal agenda, our manufacturing base was absolutely decimated and offshored to low wage economies. And I often think about the quotation from John Maynard Keynes, who said in 1930 that his grandchildren's generation would only be working 15 hours a week because of the march of new technology. But of course, the new technology has come, but it's not benefited ordinary working class people. The benefits have been accreted to the super rich. And as I've said, they've offshored jobs and they've not allowed or have not seen the benefits of those of that new technology actually improve the quality of life, the standard of living for ordinary working people in this country. People are working longer than they've ever done.
Even in our schools, Chris, in economics, if you choose to do economics, the idea of monetary reform is hardly touched on. Most kids, of course, don't do that subject. It's it might be considered to be a sort of career move. But can you just give us a few clues as to where you can go, whether it's documentaries, books, websites, whatever, to get up to speed on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of really good books that people could look at. I would recommend Stephanie Kelton's The Deficit Myth. That's an excellent book. Reclaiming the State by Bill Mitchell is another really important tome. And there's a really excellent documentary which is available on Vimeo. I think you may have to pay for it, but it's only a couple of quid or something. Well worth it. It's called Finding the Money. This is another Stephanie Kelton documentary, and it sort of breaks it down really, and it explodes all the myths about how governments finance their programs, as it were, and the whole Thatcher maxim that the problem with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money is totally destroyed when you watch that video. It's not a complicated situation, really. I mean, it's it's an issue, which I think when you get your head around it, you know, people then will realize that, my goodness, you know, we've been lied to for generations, really, about how the system works, and the whole austerity agenda and all the difficulties that people are experiencing are absolutely a political choice. And it doesn't have to be this way. We could actually create a good society. We could eliminate poverty if we wanted to in this country. And there are options, actually, even for local authorities to do more than what they're doing. And there are now the ability for local authorities to introduce differential discounts in their council tax, so that you could ask the rich people in every borough to pay a lot more and actually freeze or even reduce the council tax for other people. Not an ideal situation, because I think local government finance needs comprehensive reform. But in the absence of that, there are options available to local authorities to stop the cuts. But none of them are doing it. You would need to go to a referendum to the local population and get their buy-in and support for that. But I think if you went to the electorate and said, look, we want to stop the cuts and we want to ensure that you don't have an increase in your council tax. Indeed, we want to freeze or maybe even in certain circumstances, reduce it. We're going to ask the rich people in every borough to pay a lot more so that we can stop the cuts and start improving our public services. And you could even get into a dialogue then with the local community as to where they would like to see the additional resources being directed, so that you would then really get a real sort of interactive relationship with the public as to how the local authority works. Because most people really don't think have much sense of what a local authority does, other than maybe empty the bins and sweep the streets. Unless you have a particular issue, it might be social care or whatever, where you come into contact with the local authority. So yeah, these are things I think which can be done, but nobody's doing it, which is a real tragedy. And that's why I think we need different politicians, people with different priorities, people who actually put the people first rather than themselves or the interests of, as I've said, these big global corporations.
Well, it seems to me any kind of new up and coming politicians are either smeared or ignored one way or another. And it's quite, you know, collusion of the press to stop this. But anyway, look, I mean, the actual fact is money is going in a very different direction. It's going in the direction of things like cryptocurrencies. I was watching Edward Snowden the other day, very sceptical about these cryptocurrencies, because, without complete transparency, these things are rather like pyramid selling schemes. And because they're actually not, they have no intrinsic value. And this is a bit of a problem with any kind of money. But they're also, there's a lot of talk about digital money and particularly programmable money, Chris.
That's a very worrying trend, this central bank digital currency proposition. It's really important, I think, that we do everything we can to maintain cash in circulation in cash, because, you know, it would put enormous power in the hands of the state if you actually got rid of actual money, you know, tangible money, pound notes and so on. People's banks can be frozen, closed down. This happens to people now, but I mean, people can sort of just about survive that if they can get access to cash. But if that's gone, then that really would be, I think, a very retrograde step. And there is, you know, huge pressure to try and bring this sort of digital currency into being. And it's something I think that absolutely must be resisted.
Some people pointing out, I'd be interested to know what you think, that there's an enormous similarity between this idea of having programmable money, in other words, money you can only use for certain things, certain people can only spend it on certain things, very similar to the Chinese social credit system. So I wonder, really, is there a million miles between the West and China these days?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think, although if you look at China, I mean, it's lifted nearly a billion people out of poverty. If you look at China's foreign policy, it's one of benevolence, where they will provide really new infrastructure for countries that they want to, you know, do business with. It's a quid pro quo, obviously, but they don't indulge in the kind of gumbroke diplomacy that we've seen the West, you know, Britain, US and so on. That's the way that they've carried on really since Stalin memoria. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for China, actually, and the way they operate their system. But the social credit side is something I think that, you know, we should be worried about, because that indeed is something that could indeed, if we get the digital currency coming into being, be a situation where that could absolutely be used against people who are deemed to not be, you know, desirable citizens, as it were, people who speak out, you know, kick over the traces, you know, dissidents. And it would be a way of closing them down to an even greater extent than what happens now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, not only could you make sure people don't have hardly enough money to live on, you could also make sure that they can't do things like, say, travel, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it is pretty amazing the capabilities of this sort of technology. But I wonder if we can close by looking at a couple of stories in the news at the moment. I wonder what you make of Trump's election and the sort of people that he's choosing for his cabinet, Chris. They do seem kind of lined up against Iran, very pro-Israel, which, you know, he didn't make a big fuss about this. He said he's going to stop the chaos in the Middle East. And you do wonder whether he thinks sending a load of nukes to Iran is going to do that.
Well, that is a really worrying proposition. I mean, there was some speculation about who he might appoint, Douglas McGregor and Tulsi Gabbard. I think she does have some sort of a position. But people who are basically kind of anti-imperialists, but no, the key appointments are all raging Zionists, and you know, that is a real worry. And this nonsense about, you know, there was some sort of Iranian plot to assassinate the president, Donald Trump when he was running for president. You know, I mean, this is completely barking. I mean, this is just nonsense, and it's kind of the whole kind of thing about manufacturing consent for a pivot against Iran. I mean, I guess on the upside, it looks like he will hopefully anyway go some way towards settling and ending the war in Ukraine, a war that should never have started and indeed could have been ended a few weeks after it had started, were it not for the West and NATO's belligerence. So on that side of things, that could be positive, but it's a real worry as to what the plans are for West Asia or the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I know you do actually do a program on their state TV, don't you? Can you tell listeners whereabouts they can find that?
Yeah, Palestine Declassified. We have a Twitter thread, and we put it out on that. It's also on Rumble. Unfortunately, because of the restrictions and the West imposes, it means that the show can't be seen on YouTube or indeed on terrestrial TV any longer. I mean, Press TV was banned on a sort of pretext a few years ago now. Just as RT has now gone from terrestrial TV in this country, but it is still available on Rumble and on social media, on things like Twitter, etc. And we do a weekly program where we expose the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. And we've been running the show now for getting on for 3 years.
Finally, assisted dying. I can't help but thinking, I kind of prefer the idea of assisted living, Chris. What do you think of it?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, that. I've seen some heartrending stories about people who, with a terminal illness and in terrible pain and so on, and who've wanted to, you know, have their life brought to a dignified end. But then there are others who I think are worried that, you know, it could, you know, could end up with some sort of mission creep, and there could be, people could end up being, you know, pressurized into being assisted to die. So I mean, I think my instinct would be to support the wishes of someone who is in a, you know, a very advanced state of a terminal illness, who are in great pain, to have that right end their life if that's, you know, their settled wish, as it were. But I do understand that it's a very tricky moral dilemma
Well, it comes in the context of what we were talking about earlier, which is this collapse in elderly care. You know, this is care in the background. It's almost as if, you know, I was saying earlier on, the government doesn't like farmers. It's like they don't like elderly people either.
Oh, well, they certainly seem to have been waging a vendetta against the older citizens, which is, you know, politically crazy, because, you know, it's older people that tend to vote more than the rest of the population. And so it's almost you've kind of got a death wish, a kind of, you know, a political death wish, a kind of a one-term death wish, really, for the Labour government, because I can't think many older people will be willing to vote Labour at the next election, given what the Labour government has done right now. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important that, well, we should be certainly restoring things like the winter fuel allowance and the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, it's really important that we have really good, high quality social care and palliative care. And so that, you know, in those circumstances where I talked about somebody in the advanced stages of a terminal illness who wanted to exercise the right to have their life ended, that, I mean, I think if you had a functioning social care system, I think that, you know, the fear about people being coerced or whatever, you know, would be less of an issue if you know, if we had a functioning social care system in this country. And this is what, yeah, we should be pushing for, of course, because, as I say, it's certainly doable, and the money's not an issue. The only issue is you know, recruiting the staff and building the facilities to make sure that people have places to go, as it were.
So it's like you're saying there actually is a magic money tree.
Yeah, there is. I mean, money's no issue. Money's not the issue. The government has all the money it needs. There is literally no limit to the money that the government has access to. What is limiting, though, is the availability of real resources and the importance of avoiding inflation. And that obviously is linked back to the real resources. If you exceed the resources that are available in the economy by spending too much, then you're going to create shortages. You're going to be demand then for those scarce resources, and that will generate inflation. So that's what it needs to be in mind. So it's not like you can't sort of spend without limit. Of course, there are limits on how much a government can spend, but it's not the availability of money. It's not how much taxes. That doesn't determine how much the government can spend. Taxes, as I've said, are there to generate value for the currency and to, you know, bear down on inflation and the other aspects that I mentioned about driving consumer spending in certain directions, dealing with inequality, etc.
Yes, I seem to remember Jeremy Corbyn talking about quantitative easing for the people rather than
people's quantitative. Absolutely. Unfortunately, though, when Jeremy became the leader, he then jettisoned all that. I mean, I think that was really John McDonnell that, you know, didn't really buy into that. But yeah, I mean, at that point in time, when Jeremy was standing for leader the first time around in 2015, he was being on the economic policy, was being advised by Richard Murphy, the founder of the Tax Justice campaign. And yeah, I mean, the people's quantitative easing was something that Richard was pushing forward. And indeed, that's how Jeremy's whole economic offer at that point in time was dubbed Corbynomics. But then Corbynomics was never taken forward. It's a real shame.
And you know what it makes me think, Chris? I'm thinking about the, you know, the fact that that this QE money is all going towards propping up share prices and asset prices, going to corporations. And I'm also comparing that to what's going on with the farmers. You know, it's almost like that. Well, the idea of the family is very old fashioned. I mean, of course, a corporation or a trust doesn't die, so it doesn't have to pay any inheritance tax. Whereas the people, it's like they've set up a system which favours big corporations. Slowly, surely, people are impoverished. I'd love to know how much wealth has slowly changed hands from families, even wealthy families, back, say, in, you know, time of the Second World War to today. I think most of the wealth now is in the hands of these massive corporations, and paying tax.
It is. I mean, as I've said, I mean, inequality, though, did sort of narrow over the period between 1945 through to the late 1970s. And don't forget, in 1974, when the Labour went to the country in the general election, its manifesto committed the government to bringing about an irreversible shift in the balance of wealth and power in favour of working people and their families. Unfortunately, when Jim Callaghan became Prime Minister after Harold Wilson stepped down and Dennis Healey, as I mentioned, went to...
Hang on. Well, Harold Wilson was elbowed out, wasn't he? I mean, you know, the Wilson plot and all that by MI5, well, by the army.
Oh, well, I know there was a plot, although I think when he decided to step down, I don't think they were behind that. I think Harold under the early stages of dementia setting, and I think that's what
well, it may have had something to do with it, but in his memoirs he does talk about, you know, there being things like burglaries around him, lots of pressure being put on him personally.
No doubt about that. And, you know, we saw what was happening when Jeremy Corbyn became the leader. This is obviously somebody who was in opposition.
What we need is another one of those for the Labour Party, isn't it? A Wilson or a Corbyn.
Well, we certainly do. I mean, I think, I know in some ways Wilson gets a bad press, but, you know, a lot was achieved under his premiership. And my goodness me, you know, give me Harold Wilson any day of the week than the characters
that
we've got.
Yeah, he kept us out of the Vietnam. He kept Britain out of the Vietnam War as well, didn't he? He did a pretty reasonable job. Anyway, look, Chris, I'm rambling a little bit now, but I wonder if you could just finish by sharing with our listeners again how we find your Palestine Declassified and also follow you on socials.
Yeah, well, I mean, follow me on Twitter at Darby Chris W, at Darby Chris W, and Palestine Declassified is at P Declassified, and that's on Twitter, and that's where you can get updates on what we're up to, and if people are interested, I'd be grateful for the follow.
And they can even join the party if they wish. Okay, Chris Williamson.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Deputy the Workers' Leader Party for sure, yeah. Of the Workers' Party. Thanks very much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you.